Welcome back, everybody. This is Dylan and Owen. We are feeding you another episode of Crackcast today. Owen, what chapter are we doing?
We are doing chapter 16, the dizziness and vertigo.
Ooh, yeah, that's going to be fresh. We got quite a few questions for you today. It's a bit of a complex topic. Bear with us. It's fall out here on the prairies and elsewhere in the world, I guess, if you subscribe to normal calendars. So get a PSL or pumpkin spice latte. Enjoy the podcast. We'll continue on. Again, Owen and I are really happy to be back here. Owen just had a wonderful Halloween. We're releasing this a couple of days after. How was Halloween, Owen?
It was great. We dressed my little kid up in a cow costume. It was pretty cute.
For those people who don't know how cute Owen's kid is, it is actually absurd.
Objectively, she's pretty cute.
She's a pretty cute little ham. That's good, man. I'm glad you had a good Halloween. You ready to get cracking on this episode?
Yeah, let's do it.
Tight, man. All right, lead us off with the core concepts, my man.
Okay, so first up, associated neurological complaints such as imbalance, dysarthria, or numbness raise the likelihood of TIA or stroke as the cause of the patient's dizziness and vertigo.
That's an important point, guys. You know, having vertigo or dizziness plus some other neurologic complaint, think a central cause. Key concept number two, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, or BPPV, requires head movements to elicit symptoms. Consequently, the Hall-Pikes test should not be performed if the patient is actively symptomatic during history taking and the patient's head has not recently been moved, because such a history is inconsistent with BPPV.
Key concept three, when performing the Hall-Pike test, the head should be turned to the side 45 degrees prior to laying the patient back into the head hanging position.
Key concept number four, a positive Hall-Pike's test should elicit upbeating nystagmus.
Next up, key concept five, the Epley maneuver is used to treat posterior semicircular canal BPPV, which is the most common subtype of BPPV.
Key concept number six, central causes of nystagmus are more likely when the patient has purely vertical nystagmus, downbeating nystagmus, meaning the fast phase beats towards the nose, if the nystagmus is non-fatigable, direction changing with gaze, or spontaneous pure torsional nystagmus.
Key concept seven, the presence of auditory symptoms suggests a peripheral cause of the vertigo.
Ooh, good point there. Key concept number eight, acute vestibular syndrome is diagnosed when dizziness develops acutely, is constant, is accompanied by nausea and vomiting, unsteady gait, nystagmus, and intolerance to head motion, and persists for longer than a day.
Key concept nine, neck injury can cause vertigo from vertebral artery dissection, resulting in posterior circulation ischemia.
Those Jito chops will get you every time. Key concept number 10.
Or chiropractic neck manipulation.
Yeah, don't do that, guys.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. Key concept number 10. Abnormal nystagmus is the cardinal sign of inner ear disease and the principal objective evidence of abnormal vestibular function.
Key concept 11. HINTS, which is head impulse, nystagmus, and test of skew, is a bedside oculomotor examination that has been proposed as a way to differentiate central from peripheral vertigo in patients with a first ever onset of constant vertigo or acute vestibular syndrome.
Key concept number 12, not as relevant for most of our Canadian listeners, but for our American listeners and those listening internationally around the world, antivert or meclizine has a time of onset of approximately 1 hour.
And finally, key concept 13, do not prescribe benzos to patients with vestibular neuritis or labyrinthitis who are discharged home. Such medications can interfere with the process of vestibular rehabilitation.
You want these people to get better, not worse. Perfect.
All right, let's do some core questions.
All right, man. Today we have 13 core questions for you today, all right? The first core question we want you guys to answer is, what is dizziness and what pathologies can cause it?
All right, core question two, define vertigo and acute vestibular syndrome.
Smells like that was already talked about. We're spaced repetition there.
Nice.
Core question number three, we ask, what three systems are involved in the maintenance of equilibrium and how many of these systems must be affected to cause dizziness or vertigo?
Core question four, trace the neuronal impulse from the vestibular apparatus to the muscle end plate.
Ooh, nice. Yikes. Core question number five, we ask you guys to define nystagmus. Seems simple, but there's some elements to it that you might not expect.
Core question six, list five peripheral causes of vertigo. This is based on a table in the text.
Core question number seven, we are going to ask you to list five central causes of vertigo. And again, that is a table in the text.
Core question eight, differentiate between central and peripheral vertigo based on history and clinical exam findings.
In question number 9, we are going to take a little bit of a turn, and we're going to ask you guys to describe the Dix-Hallpike test.
Core question 10, outline your approach to the HINTS exam.
In core question number 11, we're going to be looking at what the Epley maneuver is and what pathology it treats.
Core question 12, describe the barbecue roll test and which pathology it treats. Sounds tasty.
Sounds amazing. I'm hungry now. In core question number 13, the last core question of the day, we're going to ask you to outline your algorithm for managing the acutely vertiginous patient.
All right, and on to some wisecracks. So wisecrack 1, what diagnoses cause both vertigo and hearing loss?
I bet that's a tight list.
It sounds pretty tight.
Tight. Wisecrack number 2, we are going to ask you what features of nystagmus suggest a central pathology.
Wisecrack 3, what is truncal ataxia or titubation?
That was a nice dish.
It is. And what typically causes it?
Perfect. Let's jump right into Roses in Perspective, guys. Like we said, we're back at it again in Saskatchewan, serving guys up another tasty teaching session from Rosen's 9th edition. We're looking at Chapter 16, Dizziness and Vertigo. As we've done previously, we're going to put you guys in the right mindset for this podcast with another anxiety-provoking case, because that's exactly what we like to do here on Crackass. We like to scare you and then give you the information to quell that fear, okay? So the case is this. You're cruising through the ED on a bright and sunny autumn day. Avi, hello, it's Saskatchewan, a lot of sunlight. When the nurse from triage comes to you, they have just placed a 35-year-old female with complaints of dizziness and headache in bed 4. While her vital signs were normal, the nurse seems really uneasy about her. When you ask why, she says that she's seen a number of migraineous patients come into the ED over the last 20 years of her career, but every single one of them could walk. She said that when you went to place the patient in bed, she took about 3 steps and she veers off to the right and falls to the ground. Also, the nurse is telling you that the patient is acutely dysarthric and that her eyes seem to be twitching spontaneously. So you put down that $14 pumpkin spice latte, shout out to Starbucks, and make your way to see her. En route, you start to lament about all the possible causes of this patient's presentation, and you walk in the room. If this case makes your head spin, don't fret. Your friendly neighborhood hosts at Crackass will take you by the hand and make the topic of dizziness a little bit less vomit-inducing. You'll likely see a lot of these cases in the ED. It's an exceedingly common presentation of eMERGE patients. And while most of the causes of dizziness are benign, there are a few monsters that are lurking in the shadows that can cause your patient serious harm. So having a solid grasp of the material that we present today is absolutely key. A particular concern in the patient with acute dizziness, we think about vascular pathologies. In fact, one study that Rosen's lists said that patients who have been discharged from the ED with either a diagnosis of vertigo or dizziness, NYD, had a 2-fold increased risk of vascular events in the next 3 years. And so these people can be holding down some serious pathology. To give you guys the knowledge you need to steward your next patient with a dizziness or vertigo, we are going to give you a solid understanding of dizziness and the pathologies that can cause it. We'll review the neurologic circuits that can contribute to your patient's dizziness, and then review the ways to diagnose and treat them. We'll focus on vertigo towards the end and give you a tight list of central and peripheral causes, and give you a good outline for the history and physical exam that you're going to use to decide whether or not you want to involve your friendly neighborhood neurologist. As always, we'll end with a couple quick snappers like we were saying before in the wisecracks and let the credits roll. So sit back, slurp that PSL, and listen up.
I do enjoy a good pumpkin spice latte.
Of course you would enjoy a pumpkin spice latte.
I'm a basic white girl at heart.
Basic. All right, let's jump to the core questions. Owen, you're going to take the first one. I want you to answer core question number 1. What is dizziness and what pathologies can cause it?
All right, dizziness. So we have all had shifts where the weak and dizzy patients fill up the waiting to be seen column of our computer screens. And discerning what truly is the cause of your patient's dizziness is oftentimes difficult. So having an operational definition and a tight list of the most likely causes of your patient's dizziness is important. As per Rosen's 9th edition, dizziness is defined as an extremely common yet complex neurologic symptom that reflects a disturbance of normal balance perception and spatial orientation. Patients often use this as a catch-all term for a sensation of motion, weakness, lightheadedness, unsteadiness, emotional upset, and depression. And rarely can they differentiate to you what specific feelings for them make up their dizziness.
They can never describe it. I don't understand it. You give them these clear, it's like my dad. It's like he was having it sounded like ischemic chest pain. And he goes into the emergent Calgary and he's like, are you having chest pain? He's like, well, I'm like, bro, that's a yes or no question. Unfortunately, dizziness is complex. Keep going on. I'm sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm.
No, I agree. But no one can tell you what they're actually feeling. Yeah, anyways. So with that caveat, there are a few broad categories that Rosens gives us that help us sometimes elucidate the potential cause of this complaint. So these are vertigo, which is the illusion of motion, often described as the room spinning, near syncope, which is a feeling of being faint or lightheaded, disequilibrium, which is a sense of unsteadiness of gait, and nonspecific dizziness, which is often related to polysensory disorder with a component of anxiety or just other contributing causes.
You know, just a touch of anxiety.
So there are those classic four categories. However, patients are often not great at differentiating those.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, but don't lose hope. We're going to give you a couple more tools in your toolbox to approach dizziness. So we're going to keep going here. Question two, define vertigo and acute vestibular syndrome.
All right. So like we said above, vertigo is the illusion of motion. Okay. Patients will describe the room as spinning. That's a classic question that everybody asks. But remember that the sensation of motion isn't just necessarily that the room is spinning. Okay. I oftentimes find it really helpful to kind of rephrase the question by asking my patients about if they are having the perception that either themselves or objects around them are shifting, moving, or kind of shaking in any way. I mean, like vertigo, by definition, is the sensation of motion without movement. And that's not necessarily of the patient. It can also be of surroundings as well. But if they have this kind of vague sensation that they're moving or they're kind of swaying when they're stationary or that things are kind of not stable in their environment or swinging or spinning around the room, then that's probably vertigo, and I'll help you hunt it down. Like we said, it's very hard to elucidate and pick between these things, but often, as the tried and true med school tact goes, you start general and then you narrow down with specific questions. Important to elucidate for sure, but usually the subtly vertiginous patients are the ones you actually have to worry about. The people who have what we're going to talk about next, acute vestibular syndrome, are oftentimes clinically obvious, and they'll describe exactly what you need them to describe in very clear terms because they're so unbelievably affected by it. But the people who have this like subtle grumbling new onset sensation of motion or listlessness or unsteadiness are oftentimes the people that require a little bit more thorough investigation because they could be housing pathologies, particularly central pathologies of their symptoms. In terms of what acute vestibular syndrome is, it includes vertigo, but the diagnostic criteria are a little bit more comprehensive. So acute vestibular syndrome is defined as the following, okay? You have a clinical condition in which dizziness or vertigo develops acutely, is constant, and persists for longer than 24 hours. Arbitrary cutoff, but that's what we use, okay? Acute vestibular syndrome is by definition also accompanied by nausea, vomiting, unsteady gait, nystagmus, and intolerance to head motion. To give you guys kind of a good way to remember it, not all patients with vertigo have acute vestibular syndrome, but all patients with acute vestibular syndrome have vertigo. Generally, these people with acute vestibular syndrome, like I said, are clinically obvious, but good to keep those definitions in mind. All right, Owen, question number three, I want you to answer the following, okay? I want you to tell me what three systems are involved in the maintenance of equilibrium and how many of these systems must be affected in order to cause dizziness or vertigo.
All right, so I want you to put on your overalls and tool belt because we're about to transform into electricians for this question. Nice. Thinking of yourself as a Red Seal tradesman when you are dealing with all things neurological is important as it helps simplify things a little bit. So neurologic issues can be traced to lesions somewhere in the neuronal circuit. So, much like an electrician traces a line to see the short, a physician dealing with a patient with vertigo needs to trace the circuit to discern where the lesion lies. So, in general, there are four systems or structures that are involved in maintaining equilibrium. These systems and structures are the visual system, vestibular system, proprioceptive system, and the cerebellum. A loss or mismatch in any two systems can cause the perception of vertigo. So now that you know generally which systems and structures are involved in maintaining balance and equilibrium, you are one step further to finishing your apprenticeship.
Boom. Nice. That's what's up. Yeah, no, it's important. Just remember that type four things, right? There's only so many systems involved in making somebody feel like they're at equilibrium, okay? The visual system, vestibular system, proprioceptive system, and cerebellum. If you look for pathologies in these places in the patient who is acutely vertiginous or dizzy, you'll likely find your answer.
Nice. All right, so let's move on to core question four. Trace the neuronal impulse from the vestibular apparatus to the muscle end plate.
I'm glad you fed me this question. I went to a 3-year medical school, okay? I went to U of C. The equivalent of our anatomy training is, this is the brain, and they point at something that's not the brain. But I'll try my best, you know, because I'm a trooper. I'm dedicated to the people on crack gas. Thanks, Owen. In all reality, it's actually not that hard, but we have a really good tight list there for you. I'll help you trace the neuronal circuit from the vestibular apparatus all the way to the motor end plate. It involves probably 10 structures, and we'll go through it. But as hard as it can be, and this is coming from somebody who doesn't really like anatomy, as hard as it can be to memorize these innate lists, memorizing or at least having a very good working idea as to the neuronal circuits involved in maintaining certain vital neurologic functions is exceedingly important. Like Owen said before, practicing neurology is like being a human electrician, right? And you can semi-reliably trace these lines back and find pathology. There can be multiple spots where they're affected, but generally you can, with relative accuracy, see where the dysfunction's at, okay? So strap in. We're going to run through this tight list, okay? So first, the impulse for the vestibular system begins in the vestibular apparatus, the semicircular canals within the inner ear, okay? These impulses then, after they're generated, travel through to the cranial nerve 8, shout out to the acoustic nerve, what up? From the cranial nerve 8, they travel through the brainstem and enter into the brainstem just below the pons, anterior to the cerebellum. From there, they backtrack a bit into the cerebellum, and then from the cerebellum, they travel to the vestibular brainstem nuclei. There are four of these. After they exit the vestibular brainstem nuclei, they enter either one of two tracks, either the medial longitudinal fasciculus. For all you people who know about MS, this is why they get intranuclear ophthalmoplegia and vertigo, is because this structure is affected, or they travel through the vestibulospinal tract. From there, they enter into motor neurons, and then they travel to a synapse, and then they result in an impulse at the motor end plate. A little bit of a long list, but being able to trace this back, like I said, is very important. Anything to add there, Owen?
No, this is one of those things where it would be beneficial to look at a picture, as describing kind of visually what the circuit is a little bit difficult in podcast form, but just use this to kind of supplement the text and have a look at that circuit.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. I don't think there is like necessarily the best picture in Rosen's, but I'm sure you could find a picture out there on any kind of one of the sites that you use to inform yourself about other neurologic mysteries. So go ahead and check it out. All right, Owen, let's jump on to core question number five. The deceptively complex one. I want you to define nystagmus.
All right. So nystagmus is defined as the following. It is rhythmic beating of the eyes caused by asymmetrical stimulation of the extraocular muscles. So it's important to note that there are multiple variants of nystagmus and that the character, fatigability, and direction of the nystagmus can help you determine whether or not it is being caused by a central or peripheral cause. The following are typical variants of nystagmus. So we got upbeat, downbeat, horizontal, torsional, and mixed. And we're going to come back a little bit to those a bit later in the podcast.
Have you ever been like faced with a type of nystagmus that you just cannot describe to somebody?
I'm not sure. Well, maybe in some like talks, like theoretically, if you had someone with like a serotonin syndrome or something, you could see some weird eye movements that aren't technically nystagmus.
Yeah.
But
I feel like every time I see people with like true nystagmus, it's never really like purely vertical or horizontal. It's usually a torsional or a mixed picture. The way I've found around this, because not all of us are geniuses like Owen, who can perfectly describe nystagmus in every other physical exam finding out there. Hmm. Props to Owen. Is to actually, with the patient's consent, take a video with your smartphone, man. If you're eliciting nystagmus and you have any question that it shares features that would be consistent with a central etiology, keep it on your phone. And when the neurologist comes, or when you're consulting the neurologist, show them that. And they'll be able to inform you as to whether or not it's a more concerning variant. These guys see nystagmus on a daily basis and they're very good at quantifying it and qualifying it, right? And so not only will that better help your patients, but it'll better help you build your clinical acumen. Because this can often be a very difficult thing to describe and sometimes even a difficult thing to elicit.
Definitely. And something I haven't done myself, but theoretically you could do is actually do a slow-mo, like a slow motion video, and get even a better look at what those eye movements are.
Yo, that is a tight idea. Slow-mo cameras. Bless
the iPhone. Next nystagmus patient that comes my way, I need to try it, but I haven't yet.
Yeah.
All right. So core question 6, list 5 peripheral causes of vertigo.
That is another table, isn't it, Owen?
Oh, it's a sweet, sweet aroma.
Woo! That fresh table smell. What up? We are going to be looking to table 16.2 to answer question 6 here. When we look at peripheral causes of vertigo, the Rosen's gives us more than 5. They give us many. And it's not necessarily a comprehensive list, but it's a very good list. It's a good working list to have in your mind when you go into your next patient. So peripheral causes of vertigo, as per Rosen's 9th edition, table 16.2, are the following: BPPV, or benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, vestibular neuritis, labyrinthitis. Yes, those two are different. Foreign body in the ear canal, acute otitis media, perilymphatic fistula, trauma, i.e. labyrinth concussion, motion sickness, acoustic neuroma, and Meniere's disease.
Nice.
Tight list. Nothing else really we have to add. Anything for you, Mohan?
I once pulled a cockroach out of a kid's ear.
My God. I will not be sleeping for the next 8 days. Thank you so much. Let's just keep going so I can cry myself to sleep. Owen, I want you to answer question number 7. Give me 5 central causes of vertigo.
All right. So this is another table, and we're going to go through that for you. So look at table 16.2 if you want to refer back to the text, but here's a tight list of some central causes of vertigo. So first up, vertebrobasilar artery insufficiency, cerebellar hemorrhage or infarction, tumor, migrainous vertigo, MS, so post-traumatic injury, like a temporal bone fracture or post-concussive syndrome, infection, and these include encephalitis, meningitis, or brain abscess, temporal lobe epilepsy, or subclavian steel syndrome.
Ooh.
Nice.
That too is a bit of a white whale for sure. But I think I met one guy with it once.
Yeah, I think I have also met one patient who had this, at least to my knowledge.
To our knowledge. Maybe we're missing it all the time. But that's all good. Tight lists, guys. Tight lists.
All right, so next up, question 8. Differentiate between central and peripheral vertigo based on history and clinical exam findings.
So guys, this is another table, table 16.3 in Rosen's 9th edition. Peep the table in the actual book when you're reading the chapter. And remember, read those chapters and then listen to us, and then listen to us again, and then read the chapters and do the flashcards, okay? Comprehensive. But let's jump right into it. Rosen's kind of characterizes peripheral and central causes of vertigo as having differences in onset, intensity, duration, direction of nystagmus, effects of head position, associated neurologic findings, and associated auditory findings. Okay. When they look specifically at most patients with a peripheral cause of vertigo, the onset is typically sudden, whereas in the central cause, you can either have gradual or sudden. Gradual with the more lingering stuff like growing masses, MS, stuff like that. more sudden in the, you know, posterior circulation strokes. Okay. When they look at the intensity of the vertigo, peripheral etiologies typically have a severe intensity of their vertigo, but it starts to decrease over time. With central vertigo, like I was saying before, you have a very mild case of vertigo in most cases. But again, in those, you know, acute vascular events like stroke, they get a little bit more severe. In terms of the duration of vertigo, intermittent episodes lasting seconds to less than a minute are typically with BPBV the most common peripheral cause of vertigo, but you can have continuous symptoms lasting for hours to days with vestibular neuritis. In terms of central causes of vertigo, when you look at the duration, it's usually weeks to months of continuous vertigo. It sounds like hell to me, but it can be minutes for vascular causes, particularly when you're looking at posterior circulation TIAs. You can have this abrupt on-off type vertigo there. In terms of the direction of the nystagmus, and this is something that we'll repeat later, so remember the space repetition with peripheral causes of vertigo. When we look at the direction of the nystagmus, you usually have a torsional and upbeat type of vertigo with the fast face beating towards the forehead. This is very classic for posterior canal BPPV. In horizontal canal BPPV, you can have horizontal vertigo. Horizontal torsional vertigo is very common in vestibular neuritis, and labyrinthitis are other two very common causes of continuous peripheral causes of vertigo there. In terms of the direction of nystagmus that indicate a central pathology, you have to look for things like purely vertical, spontaneous, purely torsional, direction changing, or down beating, i.e. the fast face is being towards the nose types of vertigo. If they have those, your spidey senses should be tingling. You should be thinking central cause, okay? In terms of the effect of head position on peripheral causes of vertigo, typically induces symptoms in the patient with BPPV and can worsen vertigo with vestibular neuritis. In central causes of vertigo, there's usually little change with head positioning, but you can worsen vertigo. Think about doing the Dix-Hallpike test on yourself asymptomatically. You're going to get some sensation of unsteadiness. They can always worsen a bit, but typically, at least classically, as it's described in texts, head position very rarely affects central causes of vertigo to any great degree. In terms of associated neurologic findings for peripheral causes, obviously they're none. If they are present, they're probably a central cause. Remember, vertigo plus some other neurologic symptom, think central causes, okay? In terms of associated auditory findings, peripheral causes, obviously, because that's where the peripheral causes lie in the inner ear, may have associated hearing findings, meaning both tinnitus, typically seen in Meniere's disease, and hearing loss seen in labyrinthitis. You can rarely have associated auditory findings with central causes of vertigo, but again, much rarer. Could you give us a tight summary of that list, the key points that you take away, Owen?
Yeah, remembering those key points in terms of onset, intensity, duration, characterizing nystagmus, effect of head position, neural findings, and auditory findings. Just remember, peripheral is typically sudden onset, severe initially. Duration, it really depends on what's causing your vertigo. So BPPV should be transient episodes linked to head movement. If you've got like a vestibular neuritis, then that's more of a continuous vertigo picture. Nystagmus, just remember that if you've got vertical nystagmus, horizontal bidirectional nystagmus, or direction changing nystagmus, or downbeating nystagmus, those are suggestive of central cause. So just try and remember the nystagmus you get concerned about if you're seeing. Head position, unfortunately, is a little bit nonspecific. Classically, it'll bring on your BPPV, but other causes of vertigo can get worse with changes in head position as well. And for neural findings, just remember that vertigo plus. So if you've got vertigo plus they're ataxic, or vertigo plus they've got cerebellar findings, you need to go looking for a central cause. And just remember that auditory findings, on the other hand, are typically not associated with central causes.
Hell yeah, brother.
Yeah.
All right, question number 9. I'm going to flip it to my main man, Owen. Owen, I want you to describe the Dix-Hallpike test.
All right, so it's a great way of getting your patients to vomit all over your shoes.
That did happen to me once in medical school. It was tight.
Yeah, it's awesome. This test is used to confirm the diagnosis of posterior canal BPPV. So it should be used with caution or not at all in patients with acute vestibular syndrome, because they can have worsening of their symptoms when you do this. And also it's, you're looking for BPPV. Someone with acute vestibular syndrome by definition has constant vertigo. So not likely to be due to BPPV. So in terms of actually doing this procedure, I like to get my gurney ready, get the rails down, you know, just so that you have the most chance of, you know, success and not causing any injuries to the patient. I lie them down first so that their head is just hanging off the edge of the gurney so that I know the position that they're going to need to be in. Then I sit them up. I turn their head over to the side that I'm testing by 45 degrees. And then I basically count down with them, let them know what I'm going to do. And then I lay them down quickly with their head overhanging the edge of the gurney and still turn to the side that I'm testing by about 45 degrees. At this point, you have to wait for about 10 to 30 seconds and you basically look for the onset of nystagmus. You ask about any vertigo that the patient's experiencing / wipe vomit off your shoes after they puke on you.
It was all over my pants, man.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
It's like Dylan's PTSD.
Triggering it. Going back to norm right now.
After you complete your test, then you bring the patient back upright and you repeat on the other side. So a positive test, which is confirmatory of BPPV, is a latent onset of vertigo and nystagmus about 10 to 30 seconds after you do the provocative maneuver. So the nystagmus is typically upbeating and ipsilateral torsional, where the top pole beats to the downward ear. If you haven't done this before, just go on good old YouTube and watch a video before you actually do this to a patient so you have kind of an idea of the movement that you're going to be putting them through. That would be my advice.
Pro tip from Dylan. Have a trash can next to you. For God's sake, save yourselves a shower. Save yourselves, you know, crying in a corner at night. And save yourself the PTSD that I've experienced. Always bring a puke bucket. And then tell the patient if they're if you do it, they may induce their vertigo and make them vomit. And it kind of makes things a little bit better. Additionally, you just have to take care in doing the Dix-Hallpike test, particularly our old people with ankylosing spondylitis or rheumatoid arthritis or other causes that would really make their neck rigid. You can't hang their neck off the back of the bed because their spine is a board, right? And so something to consider there as well, and may actually potentially dissuade you from doing that test. But have a puke bucket and be mindful of old people's necks and do the Dix-Hallpike test when you can.
Nice. All right, so next up, core question 10. Dylan, outline your approach to the HINTS exam.
Man, I remember reading about this in medical school and being like, I am more sensitive than an MRI. Amazing. I was wrong. In reality, the HINTS exam is something I use probably at least once or twice a week. So I'm getting fairly good at it, and you guys should really do it in all of your patients with continuous vertigo. But what the HINTS exam is an acronym, first of all. It stands for Head Impulse Nystagmus and Test of Skew. It is three tests that you'll be doing, and it is designed to differentiate between central and peripheral causes of acute vestibular syndrome, i.e. constant vertigo. In most cases, you're going to be trying to differentiate between vestibular neuritis versus a posterior stroke. But really, this test was designed by neuro-ophthalmologists to better sift through those people who need to have more testing, i.e. an MRI, and who need to potentially be treated for posterior circulation strokes and central causes of their vertigo. It's actually a fairly simple exam. You should watch some videos on it. There's a great one on Canadian. There's a great post on Canadian that tells you and walks you through this whole thing. But in essence, the components of the exam are this, okay? So the first test, the HI of the HINTS acronym, okay, is the head impulse test. It involves you rapidly moving the patient's head. It's you moving, not the patient, so it's passive. And while the patient fixates on your nose, okay? You're kind of like whipping their head back and forth at intervals that they can't predict, so they can't fix their eyes or give you false positives or negatives. What you're looking for on this test, okay, is whether or not there's a catch-up saccade, meaning when you turn their head to one side, if the eyes aren't like doll's eyes, for example, that follow you as you go from side to side, then it's more indicative of a peripheral cause. So if there's a catch-up saccade, it's more likely to be peripheral. It's actually very reassuring. If there's no catch-up saccade, meaning the eyes stay glued to that one point, they stay glued to your nose despite how you're moving their head, and there's no catch-up, then it's potentially a central cause, and that necessitates a consult to a neuro and potentially an MRI, because the likelihood of you having a central cause is much higher. Okay. In terms of the next element of the HINTS exam, the nystagmus, or the N of the HINTS acronym, you're looking for nystagmus. You're going to do this by having them focus on your finger and having them track laterally. Everybody will have nystagmus with extreme lateral gaze. When you're looking for nystagmus to either indicate whether or not this test is positive or negative, you don't have to make them focus literally at like 90 degrees from center. You'll start seeing nystagmus as you are in very normal kind of fields of vision, okay? Things that would indicate a central cause is if that nystagmus, when you're having them gaze laterally to either side, is bidirectional nystagmus or direction changing horizontal nystagmus or vertical nystagmus. So if you can elicit either one of those three things, your test is positive, and that indicates that you need to speak to a neurologist who will potentially further work them up there. If you have unilateral nystagmus or horizontal nystagmus on this test, it's very reassuring for peripheral etiology there, so don't really worry about that. The last test that you do in the HINTS exam, or the TS of the acronym of HINTS, is the test of skew. This one is actually very subtle. You need to watch videos on how to do this. But essentially, it's the cover-uncover test of each eye while the patient fixates on your nose. If the patient has refixation present after you uncover their eye, then there's a potential central cause of their vertigo. If there's no refixation, meaning the pupil does not have to return back to a normal point to your nose, then there is a likely peripheral cause of their vertigo. Okay. But in reality, a reassuring HINTS exam is the following. Okay. You have a unilateral positive head impulse test, unilateral horizontal nystagmus, and an absent skew deviation, then the likelihood that you have a central cause of vertigo is limited. If you have any one of the following, either a negative head impulse test, if they have bidirectional horizontal or vertical nystagmus, or they have a positive test of skew, any one of those three, they fail the HINTS exam in terms of you cannot be reassured that there is not a central cause of their vertigo, and it necessitates a call to the experts who deal with this. Okay. There's another acronym that people use to remember what a positive HINTS exam is INFARCT. Okay. It stands for Impulse Normal Fast Phase Alternating Refixation on Cover Test. If you remember HINTS and the INFARCT acronym, you're well on your way. In terms of what I was saying before, the HINTS exam is very good. If you're a neuro-ophthalmologist, then some of the studies they've done, it has a sensitivity of 96 to 100% and a specificity of 85 to 90% at identifying posterior circulation strokes, that this actually outperforms MRI, which is amazing. However, you have to remember, like I was saying before, is that we're ED clinicians. We're not neuro-ophthalmologists. You might receive some pushback from those persons if you say that they have a positive HINTS exam, and then also recognizing that you have to take into context other findings on physical exam as well to better inform you as to what you think is best going on with this patient. But it's definitely an exam that you should get very comfortable with, because it's very useful if you get very good at it.
So I would agree. In general, HINTS is a good thing to do, but it needs to be a supplement to the other things that you're looking at. So a good gait assessment, a meticulous cerebellar exam, and just remember to be looking for those patients with vertigo plus, you know, your hard neurologic findings to try and diagnose that central vertigo.
Hell yeah, brother. Hell yeah. All right, Owen, I want you to get on to number 11, because we're trucking along here in this episode. I want you to answer, what is the Epley maneuver and what pathology does it treat?
All right, so this is the money for BPPV.
Money!
So Epley is also known as the canalith repositioning maneuver, and this is used to treat posterior semicircular canal BPPV. So to treat the affected side, You turn the head to that side, and then the sequence is performed, which I'll go through in a minute. So practically, I'll actually do this with a patient once so that they know how to do it. And I'll typically give them a little printout. There's, you just type this to Google, and there's 500 million pictures that pop up on how to do this. Mm-hmm. So there's actually no limit to the number of times that the Epley maneuver can be performed, but a quick review of up to date, it notes that it's effective the first time in about 85% of patients, and that about only 2% of people require more than 3 treatments for this to be effective. And just a little side note is, don't forget vestibular physio referrals if this is available where you practice.
Yeah, that's huge. And I didn't really understand the weight of that, but vestibular physiotherapists are amazing. And they do a lot of training to best rehab people with vestibular neuritis, labyrinthitis, other, you know, central causes of vertigo as well. And so don't forget them. Epley is great, but it's not the end all be all.
For sure.
Yeah, long and short, really, the Epley maneuvers, once you're turning their head to the affected side, you're going to essentially like turn them in the opposite direction and like 45 degree trunks, and sit in those 45 degree trunks for about 30 seconds each to try and reposition them until you completely turn them over and set them up. Videos out there, we've included a really good diagram in the show notes, so take a look. But yeah, remember that Epley maneuver, remember vestibular physiotherapists. They're magicians.
Nice. So next up, core question 12. Describe the barbecue roll test and what pathology it treats.
The barbecue roll test is not something that Guy Fieri does on divers, drones, and dives. Okay. It's something that you're going to be doing to treat horizontal canal variants of a BPPV. Essentially how it runs is this. Okay. The head is turned 90 degrees to the affected side. Then you rotate in 45 degree intervals away from the involved side. Okay. Again, much like the Epley maneuver, you're going to have each position held until nystagmus resolves or vertigo resolves, approximately 30 seconds in duration. And then you're going to move on to the next one. The maneuver is complete when the head is back in its original starting position. So you're essentially rotating them with them lying flat in bed, 360 degrees, just waiting in every 45 degree chunk, 30 seconds. It's really good. The Epley maneuver, like we said above, is similar, save for the fact that it still involves you sitting the patient up at the side of the bed, laying their head over the side of the bed, and then you kind of roll them up sideways. We too, for the barbecue roll maneuver, because it's so saucy and delicious, have included a great diagram here in the show notes, so I recommend that you check it out. But yeah, that's the barbecue roll maneuver.
Nice. Going to Flavortown.
Flavorton. That is my nickname, by the way. Chrissy calls me the mayor of Flavorton.
I'll start calling you that too.
Please call me the mayor of Flavorton. Crackass listeners, please call me the mayor of Flavorton, because I'm including all these tasty tidbits in your life. It means the world to me because I have nothing else that makes me happy but medicine. I'm kidding. I had a dog. I'm not that depressed.
Whatever. You're going to be a dog parent soon.
Yo, I'm going to have a dog, guys.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be tight. Little Jeopardy.
Little Jeffrey.
All right, I want to take us through question number 13, man. I want you to outline your approach to managing the vertiginous patient.
So there are two main branches here. First up, we want to identify if the patient has a specific cause of vertigo that has a disease-specific therapy. And then we'll talk about symptomatic treatment for your vertiginous patients. So there's a few instances where there's some disease-specific treatments. So vestibular neuritis, these patients generally benefit from steroids. There is no evidence for antivirals at this time. Vestibular migraine, basically, they still get some of the same vestibular suppressant medications, but you would be considering giving them some migraine prophylaxis if this is a recurrent thing for them. BPPV, we've talked in depth about the cannulith repositioning maneuvers and vestibular physio. Meniere's disease, so this is basically like a fluid buildup in the inner ear. So thinking of things like salt restriction, vasodilators and diuretics to help avoid that fluid buildup and also avoidance of caffeine and nicotine. MS, which has several disease-specific therapies that we're not going to talk about here, but basically if their vertigo is due to their MS, you treat the underlying cause. It should hopefully improve things a bit for them. Vertebrobasilar ischemia or stroke, basically this is your standard stroke treatments and standard secondary prevention, so like ASA, Plavix, that kind of stuff. Ramsay-Hunt syndrome.
Ooh, that's a fresh one. I haven't heard that one in a while.
And you treat this with antivirals and steroids. Acoustic neuroma, these patients need surgery, potentially radiation. In terms of your symptomatic therapy, so there are three main classes of vestibular suppressant medications. So you got your antihistamines. So in Canada, I mean, CERC is something that we sometimes use with not a great evidence base for it in the setting of BPPV and other vestibular problems. But other antihistamines like meclizine, dimenhydrinate, and diphenhydramine can also be used. Benzos, if your antihistamines are not cutting it, so thinking of things like diazepam, lorazepam. And then finally, antiemetics. So while your Gravel and Benadryl do have a bit of an antiemetic effect, you can also bring in some other classes here. So you're on ondansetron, metoclopramide, and then your prochlorperazine and promethazine as well.
Nice.
So any other thoughts, Dylan?
No, I think it's just like it's important to recognize that like having an approach to managing the acute hypertension's patient kind of comes out to three steps, right? First, you want to find out what the problem is using history, physical exam, plus minus imaging, okay? And then you want to treat those specific etiologies if you can identify them, looking at vestibular neuritis, giving them the steroids, because it's thought to be like almost like the Bell's palsy of the inner ear type thing. Treating people with Meniere's disease or the inner ear high drops with salt restriction, vasodilators, stuff like that, and referral to the people they need to be referred to. And then you also have to have a tight kind of approach to symptomatic therapies, right? Because a lot of these people will come in acting the same. And so there are things that at least acutely in the ED that you can give, whether that's antihistamines, benzos, or other antiemetics, important. Just remember those three, kind of find out what the issue is, treat the specific issues. And then if you can't really identify the issues and you want to treat them symptomatically, or you were treating them symptomatically in the interim until you can find those issues, use those three classes that we talked about.
So let's move on to the wisecracks. So wisecrack number one, what diagnoses cause both vertigo and hearing loss?
Guys, this is a pretty tight list, okay? If you think about it, the vast majority of people who have hearing loss have peripheral etiologies of vertigo. We spoke to that in the key concepts. And central causes, like we were saying also earlier in the episode, can rarely cause hearing loss. But usually if your patient's newly deaf in one ear, you're going to think in a peripheral cause. So there are five causes of peripheral vertigo that will also be accompanied by hearing loss. Okay, Meniere's disease, the hearing loss typically comes after resolution of the vertigo. And then they have accumulating hearing loss in that ear. Okay. The second on this list is labyrinthitis. Labyrinthitis will cause hearing loss, and that's how you differentiate it from vestibular neuritis. Labyrinthitis will cause hearing loss. Vestibular neuritis will not. Okay. Other causes of peripheral vertigo and hearing loss include acute otitis media. Obviously, they have a lot of fluid in there. Their tympanic membrane isn't doing its job. Okay. Acoustic neuroma. Yes, the white whale can also cause hearing loss and vertigo. And then foreign body in the ear canal can also cause vertigo. Tight list, five things there. Think peripheral and work your way through. On to wisecrack number two. Owen, I want you to tell me what features of nystagmus suggest a central pathology, and I want you to take our listeners through some space repetition.
All right, so this is another list, and this is kind of one of the embedded secret lists that we talked about last time, just for those that are doing their exam prep. Remember, Rosen's is chocked full of these as well. So we have a DDL for you, which is a Dylan's Distilled List.
The mayor of Flavortown is frying up DDLs all day.
Trademarked?
Trademarked.
In case you're wondering.
Flavorton, okay? It's different than Flavortown. I'm not a guy, okay?
All right. So this is the DDL for features of nystagmus that suggest a central cause. First up, purely vertical nystagmus. Secondly, downbeating nystagmus with the fast face towards the nose. Third, non-fatigable nystagmus. Fourth, direction-changing nystagmus with changes in gaze. And finally, fifth, spontaneous pure torsional nystagmus. So we've got a DDL for you.
It's a DDL. Just remember those five, guys. And I mean, like, it's hard for you to remember all of these things when you're seeing your next vertiginous patient. But if you can take this, this is a very important thing to take away, because if you can sit and think about the things that you don't want to be the cause of your patient's vertigo, they're largely central. And so memorizing the features of nystagmus that are indicative that there's a central cause is important. So think about the purely vertical, downbeating nystagmus, non-fatigable nystagmus, direction-changing nystagmus, or spontaneous pure torsional nystagmus. All of those speak to a central cause and should get your spidey senses tingling.
And finally, wisecrack three. What is truncal ataxia and what typically causes it?
Truncal ataxia. The first time I heard that, it was from one of my favorite South African rural practitioners here in Saskatchewan. He practices up north. I was a nursing student at the time. And so that's how I really remember. It sticks in my mind. It's using the Afrikaans accent to say truncal ataxia. Enough with that, though. Truncal ataxia, something that you don't actually commonly see in clinical practice, but when you see it, you actually won't forget. It's so striking, and it'll kind of be seared into your mind. In essence, what truncal ataxia is midline torso instability. These patients can have a gross ataxia associated with it, but when we're talking about truncal ataxia, you often see it when they're not moving. They're actually sitting in bed. They often have to sit upright, and stabilize themselves with their arms to maintain their midsection upright. Also, you might see the patient with truncal ataxia having these abnormal swaying movements of the head and trunk. But really, that's what typifies truncal ataxia, is this midline truncal instability. They're not really able to keep themselves upright. They're kind of slumping in bed when you try and stand them, or when you try and sit them up and don't let them use their arms to stabilize them. They'll kind of slump back down in bed again, right? If you see truncal ataxia in isolation, it's actually very reliably caused by lesions in the midline cerebellar structures. Interesting, but if you see truncal ataxia, particularly in isolation, think midline cerebellum as an area of a focal lesion. And almost, I mean, like, I know it's not technically a focal deficit or one that we typically conceptualize as a focal deficit, but if I see truncal ataxia, particularly in the vertiginous patient, I'm thinking that there's a midline cerebellar lesion. That's it for today, guys. Thank you for hanging in with us. Owen, how did you feel? We're back at it again. You know, I was gone all month. I was in Regina. I was in the promised lands. Did you miss me?
Promised lands. It's good to have you back.
Man, good to see you again. It's good to be back. Like we said before, I'm getting a dog. We got a dog, Dad. The mayor of Flavorton, with frying up them DDLs, is also going to have a little baby corgi on his hip. Maybe I'll introduce you guys to him, and maybe I'll record some videos and put it online. But we always want to say thanks for supporting the podcast. We have strong listenership right now. I think we're like averaging 5,000 downloads a podcast, which is huge. So nice. Thank you guys, everybody out there in podcast land. A special thanks goes out also to our friends who run the Association of Alberta Family Physicians. They put us on their website as a potential CME type resource that their practitioners can use. So thank you for putting us out there. We love doing this stuff. We love being able to talk to you guys about the stuff. We love the content creation. So, you know, if you ever have any questions or concerns, just drop us a line, put a comment. We'll respond to it as soon as we can. I mean, we're residents, so our lives include sitting at the hospital and crying all the time. But we will get back to you as soon as we can. We really do appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right. Cheers.